our yet as untitled podcast about games. We're going to start off with just what we thought about E3. I'm here with my friend Lewis.
How you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. And yourself?
Yeah, living life.
Good stuff.
Should probably introduce yourself as well.
Yes, I'm Brandon, if you didn't know that already. And yeah, we're just going to kick it off. What we liked, what we didn't like, what was a little strange. There's always plenty of that at E3. So we'll just start from there. How about you go first, Lewis? What kind of things do you like?
Yeah, well, I suppose we should get the obvious one out of the way first. Cyberpunk, Keanu, and all the memery that happened after that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty... Like, obviously, I'm massive into Witcher 3, so I've been waiting for this one with bated breath. I'm a sucker for that kind of aesthetic anyway.
Yeah.
Keanu was... I'm surprised at how kind of instantly fine everyone was with it. Just, I suppose it works because it is Keanu, and he is, like, best boy at the minute.
Definitely.
But... It's rare for something to be that blindsiding and yet positive at E3.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's because he embraced it. He embraced the fact that it was going to be cringy. He knew it was going to be strange.
Yeah.
And I think the audience knew that as well. And I think probably the fact that they were all half pissed as well.
Yeah, probably did help.
But yeah, no, I liked it. I thought it was a cool announcement. And you know, this is a banner year for Keanu Reeves as well. Yeah. He seems to be doing pretty well just now for himself. So.
Yeah, for sure.
So bringing him out was always going to be a surefire win for them.
Yeah, like I suppose maybe it is just because Cyberpunk has maintained such a positive aura around it the whole time. There's been a couple of things.
Yeah, it's embroiled in a pretty bad debate at the moment. Anyway.
Yeah, but that came kind of after E3, like with the ad. Obviously, I imagine we'll maybe talk about it at some point.
Yeah.
I suppose it was just like a perfect marriage. Like even within this E3, there was other celebrity cameos that kind of fell flat or just sort of fine.
Yeah.
Like you had like John Bernthal was one for Ghost Recon
and his dog.
And yeah, everyone's talking about the dog. But I suppose that makes sense. And the weird one for me, which wasn't expected, was AJ Styles and one of the people for the New Day hiding under the stage for the Gears.
Yeah, very strange. Thing. Very strange. Yeah. And they had the Twitch rivals, Rainbow Six Siege, Lil Yachty, and what's the other guy?
T-Pain,
yeah, that was good fun.
My boy, T-Pain.
So that was good, yeah, and I think that the Keanu things definitely help Cyberpunk, especially with the transgender debate that's going on right now. It's managed to put it in a little more of a positive light.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people are quite upset by that.
Yeah. Understandably so, I guess.
Well, it's a difficult one. I was listening to an interview with Laura Dale, who used to work for Kotaku, and she talking about it and said that the argument that they're making that it's the world, you know, it's the cyberpunk world, you know, corporations use sexuality and the image of sexuality to sell things, you know, mm-hmm. and you know, and it's in a world in which transgenderism is now accepted, but in lieu of that also you now have it's also used as a commodity, you know, it's been commodified as well as socially accepted. And she says that argument begins to break down because they're also at the same time that you've got them doing that, they're also selling the game itself by giving press a big statue of a sexy woman down on her knees with her tits hanging out, you know. So I get that argument, and I think it is sort of a little hypocritical of them to say that when they themselves are also using the same marketing techniques.
For sure. I think part of the issue as well, like, it seems to be an issue within cyberpunk as a genre generally. Like, I remember when the new Blade Runner came out, there was a similar thing about the objectification of women and things like that. I think the kind of problem does arise from the fact that regardless of how it is within the society that the product's based in, it's a question that is still sort of being asked by our society. We're sort of kind of deciding where we stand on trans issues, and like, even within things that we'd maybe think would be sympathetic, there's bits of nuance. So I think like that might be part of the problem, is symbolically, like the ad that we're talking about in question, the mix it up. I could see how people could be a bit sensitive about that.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, exactly. And I think that it is just because it's such a sensitive issue right now, it's always going to is going to cause a stir like that.
Yeah, for sure.
And at the same time, you know, in much the same way that corporations will use that image to get publicity, you know, corporations today will use that image to get publicity. And yeah, I think definitely. That people are all too quick to create a video or write an article about the subject matter yeah. in order to, you know, get the clicks. You know, yeah. What is it called? SEO. You know, it's all about getting that traffic. Yeah, for sure. So.
Yeah.
But let's jump on from that because we could end up speaking yeah, for the whole time yeah. about it.
How about you go? You go for something.
Okay, well, I'll start off with a bit of a weird one, actually, a bit of a smaller one, because I've been reading quite a lot about it lately, and I'm quite excited for it. A little game called Carrion, if you remember seeing that.
Remind me.
So basically, if you imagine The Thing mixed with Super Meat Boy.
Yes, I remember this now.
Where you play as this big... gelatinous blob, exactly, in some sort of secret government facility, and yeah. you control all its different tendrils and tentacles, and basically have to navigate the world
yeah.
whilst also consuming all the scientists and solving puzzles. It's quite similar to Playdead's Inside as well, if you've played that as well. I won't spoil it, but there's a sequence in that as well that's quite similar to it, and yeah, I'm really excited for that. And as a fan of Super Meat Boy as well, the gameplay immediately yeah. when I saw it, I was like, that's exactly the kind of game that I like to play. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. An indie project's been picked up by Devolver now, hasn't it?
It's picked up by Devolver, so yeah. it was in Devolver's presentation.
Yeah, Devolver presentation was a Devolver presentation.
Yeah, exactly. No, I really, really liked it as well. I thought it was clever, and I feel like their things have always sort of been quite reflexive on the state of like corporate video game events every year that they come out, and they're always sort of made a joke about the fact that these things are really jilted live events, and then for them to say, oh, you know, clearly we're seeing that the trends are changing, and now people are doing, you know, the Nintendo Direct and the PlayStation mm-hmm. State of Play and that sort of thing, so that's like, we'll do our own version of it. And I thought that was quite a cool thing for them to do.
Yeah, maybe it's one of the things that has made this E3, I thought it had its moments, like you linked me the Krovy Cat video earlier today,
yeah,
but comparatively I thought it was weirdly competent at times. Like, there wasn't as many awkward dances or jokes or
absolutely
there was still some awkward bits where they expect people to clap but they didn't, but
yeah,
you know.
There was no Commodore 64 moment, there was no Peggle 2 moment. And I was kind of sad about that, to be honest. When it got to the end of it, I quite liked the weirdly jilted corporate mm-hmm. jokes and things like that. That's part of the charm of E3, and
yeah.
I think you lose that with the Nintendo Direct. And obviously, you know, it's what they're going for. You know, it's bad publicity for them when these things come out. So they're obviously trying to avoid that as much as possible. And obviously, the Nintendo Directs are a perfect way to do that because they can completely control the pacing of it. You know,
yeah.
imagine if you had Doug Bowser coming out on stage for a Nintendo Direct and making a joke about the fact that his fighting last name is Bowser. You know, it might not have had the same effect that it had in the Nintendo Direct, where they could edit it and, you know,
yeah.
they could make the tone for themselves rather than the audience, yeah. you know, creating the tone.
Yeah, it's funny you bring up Bowser and Nintendo and that. Just one of the notes I have here is just that it reminded me that I miss Reggie.
Yeah, definitely.
I miss Reggie, man.
No, definitely. It's sad to see him go. I like him a lot, but at the same time, you know, the guy's name's Doug Bowser. You can't argue with how good that is. So yeah. I'm sure he'll be good. And I liked him in it as well. I liked him in the Nintendo.
Yeah, career. Nothing against Bowser, but like, man, I miss Reggie.
Yeah, no, definitely. He was one of the sort of champions of E3, I feel, and it's sad not to see him there, definitely.
Well, that is kind of the thing. Like, Reggie became an internet celebrity through these kind of weird conferences.
Exactly.
And now they're getting all press trained, at least to a better degree. Will we have those weird people anymore?
I'm not sure. I think there always will be, because I think that there's certain studios where they're just like, right, well, all of us are... nerds who normally spend 60 hours a week in an office together working on a computer, and now we have to go do this big huge PR event. I think there's always going to be some weird events. And as well, you know, when they try and cater and tailor to certain audiences, you're going to have people presenting aspects of it as well that aren't necessarily going to be the best trained for these situations. Like the guy that they had last year who was stumbling over the Need for Speed thing, you just couldn't read the prompter, had no idea. I can't remember the guy's name, but that was awful. And there's always going to be people like that, you know, because they're trying to cater to a specific audience.
I've forgotten about that guy.
Oh, I know, that was really hard to watch. That was probably the hardest thing to watch from last year. But on to this year. Let's hear another thing that you liked from this year.
I really liked kind of sticking with the RPG thing, I guess. Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 2 is a hell of a mouthful.
It is a mouthful, actually. That's going to be a tough sell.
Yeah, but it was a game that I always hoped would come out, but with each passing year, it just seemed less and less likely. But I suppose we're in the time of reboots and reimaginings and remakes.
Yes.
So, like, the original Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines is one of those games where it is janky as all hell. Like, the developer went bust pretty soon after it got released.
Yeah.
So they had no patches, so the game was unoptimized. It was just awful until there was a big fan patch. But it had quite a cult following. Like, the dialogue in that was all very interesting. You could go through most of the game, if not all the game, without killing anyone.
Yeah.
You could use various kind of vampiric powers to fuck with people. That made replayability pretty good. And it had the voice of Bender in it as an ancient vampire.
Oh,
so,
brilliant.
So that was pretty great. So to see another one coming out and it looking good. Like, obviously, take these things with a pinch of salt. We've all been burned before by things that have been downgraded after E3.
Of course.
I'm hopeful. I'm very hopeful. Although they had an interesting way of presenting it, like, on the floor.
I remember seeing that, where they had the badges. It was like little pins that you could go around. Oh, no, maybe that was the original reveal. I don't know if that was
E3.
But they had something before where they had a really strange reveal where people were dressed as vampires and there were different secret quests, basically, inside the press event.
That's pretty cool.
You would go up to, like, the DJ, for example, and if you said a specific thing to them, then you would get a little pin.
Yeah.
And that was the idea, to sort of, you know, make the idea that all these characters in the game could have different different quests and that sort of how the game operated.
Yeah, like, I think it was outside Xbox or something. I was watching the video, and they talked about the way that the playable inverted commas demo worked. Is you went into the booth, and there was an employee from the studio there, and they played the game, and you told them what to do, but they had to do anything that you told them to do,
right?
To see what would happen.
Right.
So, like, the way that they presented was basically showing all the ways you can be a horrible person in the little video that they did, and they were varied, and good. Like, they don't seem to have dialed back on the magic powers much, which is good. Like, one of the abilities is showing it is you basically make all the blood in someone's body boil and they explode.
Awesome. I like the sound of that, definitely.
So it's going to be good. It seems like, and most importantly, they've not fallen into the temptation of our RPG studios. The dialogue looks kind of complex. It'll be impacted by stats and by backstory and things like that.
Interesting.
Looking at you, Bethesda.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's interesting that you say that, because it sort of leads on to another thing that I think speaks to the same, one of the same praises for a game that I'm looking forward to is The Outer Worlds, the new Obsidian game, which very much it is selling itself, to me at least anyway, on the fact that you have this huge breadth of stances and different ways that you can take the narrative, you know, and in much the same way that I really hate saying it, but Fallout 3 or Fallout New Vegas, that people keep making the comparisons, and obviously they do to a certain extent want those comparisons because they're dearly loved games. But it was those sort of things that I really liked about Fallout. I liked the fact that I was the person who was, you know, charitying the story. You know, I was the person who was leading the narrative forward, and all decisions that I made would have an effect over what ultimately happened in the end, you know?
Yeah.
And they've very much tried to champion that and say, you know, look, this is what we're going for. You can kill every character in the game except one, and that will affect the story in different ways. And I'm looking forward to it. I've got high hopes for that one as well. I think the science fiction setting is exciting. It looks cool. It's a really cool color palette and all those different things. But at the same time, it's, you know, it's the same story that, you know, the Borderlands games have, you know, that so many other science fiction games have, where it's big corporate, well, you know, cyberpunk as well, you know, just big corporate overlords control everything, you've got to take them down, or you can join them, you know. So, you know, it remains to be seen whether or not they can add enough freshness to it to make it unique, but we'll see.
I hope so. The issue that could come up with it is that while it's like Obsidian and all that, I don't think Chris Avalon's working on it, because he's working on Dying Light 2.
Right, okay.
And Chris Avalon is very, very good at writing. So we'll see how it turns out. He might actually be involved. I might be misremembering, but I don't think he is.
No, I think you are right. And, you know, Dying Light 2 looks impressive as well. You know, the first one I did enjoy, but again, it was a janky game. It was hard to get into at times. And I felt like the story was a little all over the place. You know, you were just this hero dropped in this world. It was a strange story. You know, it was hard to get into. Mm-hmm. And it feels like they knew that. And that this one is a evolution of that. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm sure they did show that at E3, some gameplay of Dying Light 2. I'm not 100%, but I'm sure they did anyway. It's coming out soon. So that's interesting. And the thing that I like about that they're doing with it is, as well as your choices in dialogue and the choices that you make in quests having an effect over the story, it also has an overarching effect over how the world changes. And you'll see different territories grow or different territories diminish, buildings come up or go down, flags come up based on the decisions that you make. And I think that's quite cool to actually see the world change around you as you make these different decisions rather than just single characters interacting with you differently.
Yeah, for sure. What's your opinions on the new Pokemon? Because people seem to be real divided about it / furious about it.
About Sword and Shield?
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure why anyone's got anything to be annoyed about. I can see why people had reservations about Pokemon Let's Go, Pikachu and Eevee. I get that because it wasn't the full-fledged Pokemon game on Switch that people wanted. And as much as they told people that it wasn't going to be that, I think people expected more. But I think really it was for people who had rediscovered their love for Pokemon through Pokemon Go. And now there was this game that could bridge the gap between a full-fledged Pokemon game and Pokemon Go. So it served a purpose, and I think it's got a lot of people on board with buying Switch hardware or, you know, thinking about buying Pokemon Sword and Shield because they enjoyed those so much. I really like the setting. It's interesting because you've seen quite a few games over the past couple of years that have been inspired by British locations. We've got Forza Horizon 4. Mm-hmm. Pokemon Sword and Shield, then obviously now Watch Dogs Legion 2, which is which is in London. So I'm looking forward to it. I don't see what are the main gripes that people have.
The big issue is about the Pokedex.
Oh yes, of course. Yeah.
You're not going to be able to transfer all Pokemon along or something like that.
Yeah, no, I understand people's annoyance with that, but again, you know, I guess it's the limitations of the hardware and different things like that, and it's a new generation. It's a very big step for Nintendo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not just their new portable console, this is their new home console as well. So they've, you know, it's a different thing for them. It's a different thing, you know. It's not the same way as transferring something from a Game Boy to a DS. You know, this is a whole different beast, and I think it was the right idea. You know, I think it's too much perhaps to ask that you can have every single Pokemon ever created in that game.
I think one of the things as well, like, I've not been involved in Pokemon for a while. Like, it was Ruby the last one that I sat and properly played all the way through.
Yeah.
But for me, for a long time, part of the thing that people complain about, it was good because you had more, like, Pokemon being added to it, but there was so many that you started getting things like Trubbish.
Yeah, exactly. One that's, you know, an ice cream cone.
Or Sandcastle.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
so maybe it'll be a bit better to scope it back a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. You know, pull the reins a little bit and say, right, let's make this new generation something that people are going to really like. You know, there are obviously a lot more people are involved in Pokemon than, say, 5-6 years ago because of Pokemon Go, and also now because of Detective Pikachu as well.
Yeah.
You know, Pokemon is very much something that's in people's minds right now. And I think that they want to get this right. And I think maybe to say, you know, let's throw all, what is it, 5-6 generations of Pokemon back into the game. I think that could even throw people off a little bit with too much to do, you know. So it's an interesting one. But yeah, I get people's gripes. But at the same time, you just got to see it as a new thing. It's a totally new entity, you know. It's Pokemon on a home console, which is something that they've never done before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's more positives to take from it than there are negatives.
Yeah. You brought up Forza Horizon. The big sort of pop of E3 for me, apart from Keanu Reeves, just for pure unexpectedness, maybe it's something that's been announced, but the Lego Forza thing, that kind of came out of left field for me.
Yeah, well, it's one of those ones that I thought the same as well, and I was like, this is really strange. But then I thought about Forza Horizon 3, and they had that Hot Wheels DLC, So it was like a, it was basically a giant Hot Wheels track above the world of Forza Horizon 3. So I guess it kind of makes sense, and I feel like maybe it's just a case of they're just having fun with it, you know? And that's really quite cool to see, you know, that they're like, screw it, you know, let's put Lego in Forza. And it looks really good as well. That's the thing, you know, that the fidelity of those games is absolutely incredible.
So PlayStation boy pretty much solidly now. But every time a new Forza game gets announced or something, I see it again, I'm a bit sad that I can't play it.
No, I'm the same as well, and I've never been a huge fan of driving games, but there's something about the Horizon games that really just, you know, you really want to play them. They just look like good fun, you know? They really do look fun. No, definitely. Well, on the subject of new hardware with Switch being the home console, let's hear your thoughts on the new Xbox Project Scarlet, as it's known at the moment. It's yet to be seen what they will ultimately call it.
I imagine they'll call it something very focused group and boring.
Of course it will be.
Project Scorpio. That was so much better than Xbox. Was it? Was that the Xbox?
Xbox One X.
Is that One X? Yeah. I don't know. I don't. In terms of the thing itself, it intrigues me, certainly. The presentation did fall a little bit too hard into PR for me at points.
Of course, but then you have so much to show, so it's always going to be a little, you know.
Yeah, like, just in terms of it became very much the sort of joke amongst like E3 drinking game enthusiasts, the numbers thing. It came about that, but I suppose like if it's a bit of hardware, there's not really much you can do to get around that. I suppose Sony, when they just said like loading times, and that was it, but... Well, I suppose it's kind of thing about Sony, they've been very brief about details, weren't there at all.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that pans out, given Microsoft the main stage. I'm intrigued, I'm excited. For the longest time, I thought it was maybe a bit unnecessary to start a new console generation so soon after the last one, but it does seem that we're sort of hitting a ceiling, at least for developers to practically make things like grow exponentially in terms of content, in terms of fidelity and
definitely,
all that kind of stuff.
Definitely.
So did they talk about VR at all? I don't think they mentioned VR at all
No, Microsoft didn't mention it at all. Obviously I guess they do have a vested interest in it because they're doing the PC thing, but they never mentioned anything about VR with Xbox hardware anyway. And obviously Sony are the only ones really who are doing it just now, apart from Nintendo on a very small scale with the Labo stuff.
I could see that might be a way that Sony differentiates its new console from there, or maybe it'll lean into the VR a bit more.
I think so, because they have already come out and said that the old VR kit will work with the new console. And obviously there are limitations there. They've already recommended that anyone who's using the VR upgrades to a pro so that they can get a better experience anyway, so it makes sense that they'll lean into that a little more. It did sell really well, you know, despite how little it is talked about and how few real AAA games there are out there. There's plenty of VR experiences, small games here and there, but really until Truth and Blood came out, the most recent one, there hasn't really been a huge amount of big actual titles for people to delve into. So I think they probably will lean into that a little more. But again, it's getting developers to commit to making a full £50 AAA VR game, you know. And
there's the problem.
You're already segmenting a huge amount of your audience with that. Mm-hmm. And also the actual developing time of making that game is going to be, I would imagine, longer because you're having to accommodate for the VR hardware. So it's an interesting one. But yeah, I think you're right. I think there is definitely a ceiling that we're hitting now. And I think one of the things that's really showing that is when you look at ray tracing technology with computer games just now with PC. You know, you've got your RTX, NVIDIA's RTX cards, and then I'm not sure what AMD's version are, but they're coming out with those as well. And you're seeing it in games like Control, which they showed at NVIDIA's panel at E3 this year, and how... what a stark difference it makes. Even if you look at the stuff that's come out in Minecraft and in Quake 2, the huge contrast in difference just with ray tracing technology is absolutely incredible. And the ability that you could have to completely change a game by adding in this ray tracing technology is, I think, really, really obvious to people now. And I think that they want to jump onto that.
One thing just about the Microsoft presentation generally, like, my God, what a difference a few years makes. Like I remember watching the announcement of the Xbox One way back when with the Force Kinect bundle and the no trading of games and exactly. all that kind of stuff. Like, it's how it's been for the last couple of generations. It swung back and forth in a pendulum, but I'm hoping that Microsoft have learned their lesson with the previous console. Like they did a lot to repair the damage over the intervening years, but it was never enough to dissuade me off staying with the PlayStation.
No. And I think a part of that is, you know, because Sony got that jump in sales and ultimately I think ended up outselling the Xbox by 2-1.
Yeah.
So you already had, you know, vast majority of people are already on that console. And obviously cross-platform does now exist, but only on a very few select titles. And it's yet to be seen whether or not that will transfer over to new consoles. You know, that maybe this is just, you know, the goodwill of this generation. And once it comes to E3 next year, you know, it's going to be no holds barred again. Mm. And things could change very quickly once Sony's, I would imagine, back on the main stage again next year.
It's really interesting that partnership, like sharing of technology, whatever it is exactly between them over the streaming service.
Definitely.
Like, I don't know. Like, maybe it will be a good thing. Like, I won't be party to the console wars to a large extent. Like, I've got no flag to wave for the most part. So it would be nice if they came together and worked and stuff and had a more mutually sort of robust network for that kind of thing.
Yes.
Like, it's one of the things that sort of started swinging me the other way. Sony's attitude to cross-play across platforms, they do seem to be the big stick in the mud holding it back.
Definitely, and so, that, you know, part of the reason is because they have that 2-1 ratio. Yeah. You know, why sacrifice that when things are going so well?
Mm. Which is why it's interesting that they are sort of seeding their like infrastructure for their streaming, at least in large part, to their biggest rival.
Yeah.
I'd be curious to see what the agreement was.
Yeah,
like, surely that's not just that we will give you a lot of money to have this.
No, I think it is them both realizing that the gaming landscape's changing drastically and that if they don't change with it, they will be left behind. And I think it is interesting to look at because especially when you have Ubisoft's press conference and they're talking about their Uplay Plus service.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously you've got Google Stadia as well, which, you know, Uplay Plus is going to be on. And Google have said, you know, look, other platform holders or other developers, you know, or publishers can have their streaming services on Google Stadia in the same way that you could get like your BFI player or something like that on Amazon Prime,
mm-hmm.
which is really, really interesting because it doesn't take a huge leap of faith to imagine a future in which everyone's on the same device and you pay, you know, whatever it costs for your Xbox Game Pass Ultimate, but you do it on Stadia. You don't have this huge piece of hardware under your TV anymore. You know, it's just all streamed to you. 4K, 60 frames per second. They're shining Doom on that on a phone, you know? So obviously the technology's already there. You know, maybe the network infrastructure for people isn't quite there yet, but the technology to do it is certainly there.
So what are you feeling about the Stadia? Will it be a market disruptor in the way they want it to be?
I think that it could be eventually. I think that Google perhaps know that it's going to take time, but they can perhaps take the losses that it's going to incur over the next few years to get their foot in the door,
mm-hmm.
especially when they're announcing it now, when both Microsoft and Sony are talking, at least briefly, about what their new consoles are going to be. That, you know, there's going to be a few people that are going to go, hey, wait a minute, maybe I could just spend 120 quid on a Stadia and I can play all those games that I want to play. You know, not everyone plays a huge number of games. There are some people who stick to one game. They play one game for the year and that's it. So if you're someone who plays Destiny, for example, and that's all you play, why bother buying the new hardware when you can just play Destiny 3 on Stadia?
Mm-hmm.
And not only can you play it at home, but you can also play it on your phone, on your tablet, wherever you like. So I think it's an interesting one. But again, I think that it is going to take time. They're saying that they want people to have a 25 megabits per second internet connection. But I think the actual average at the moment is something about 7.5 megabits per second, the global average.
Not great.
So it's nowhere near that. And obviously that's not the reality for a lot of people. It's much faster, but there's a huge amount of people who aren't going to be able to get on board with that.
Yeah, that's like Silicon Valley and the surrounding areas and South Korea can have a Stadia.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know, and you look at PlayStation now as well. You know, they recommend 5 megabits per second, and even if you've got 50 megabits, 100 megabits per second, you're still not getting anywhere near the fidelity or anywhere near the response time that you would expect from a game of that quality.
Yeah, and a little sort of parallel between this generation and the last. And one of the things I found interesting about Sony ceding the floor to Microsoft, Miyazaki and George R. R. Martin's game being announced at a Microsoft presentation.
Yeah,
compared
definitely.
To Bloodborne being one of the consoles that's one of the consoles, one of the games that sold the PS4 for a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly. It's an interesting one. Obviously, it is coming to PS4 as well, and that's one of the things you have to wonder about, whether or not it was the right decision for Sony to make to not be at E3 this year. Like, understandably, their first party titles, or at least the titles that they're really pushing, they talked about last year, and Death Stranding obviously had the trailer come out a few weeks before E3 as well, so they didn't have to show that again. But obviously, you know, your Last of Us Part 2, Ghost of Tsushima. And I think there's a couple other ones as well that I can't think of off the top of my head. But those titles, they've already talked about at great length. You know, last year at E3, they only showed, what, 6 games or something like that? And they had huge, long, sort of drawn-out pieces about them. So why bother coming back to show those games again, especially when they've obviously talked about hardware already? But then it begs the question, you know, are there third-party publishers that they perhaps should have got on board with and run a conference anyway to highlight the fact that these games are going to be coming to PS4? Because, you know, at the moment, now people are looking at Elden Ring and seeing that as a Microsoft game in the same way they did with Bloodborne and PS4.
Yeah. I guess time will tell on that kind of thing. But we can't talk about Microsoft and not talk about Halo.
Yes, exactly. I watched that trailer with great excitement. I really, really did. And that's coming from, you know, I barely played Halo 5. I really struggled to get into it. And from seeing, obviously, how it was received critically and also, you know, on a personal level, it was subpar. It was completely subpar compared to previous titles. And I think that you could argue that Halo 4 probably was as well. And that it has gone downhill since Halo Reach. But they know that. I think 343 know that. And that's why they showed this trailer here with the Master Chief in his original Spartan armor in the same color scheme as he had in the first one. You know, I think, and obviously they've already talked about the fact that it's going to have the customization from Halo Reach, and it's going to have 4-player split screen as well. So they're really harking back to what made Halo great, and I think that's important, especially when they're spearheading this along with the new console launch as well. I think that was a really clever idea. It worked for Halo 1 and it worked for Halo 3, so why can't it work for Halo Infinite?
That for me was one of the big signs about how maybe Microsoft, obviously it's not a purely Microsoft game, it's 343, but how they've learned the lesson about the type of games that maybe want to push developers to make. Like, we remember the whole, in today's modern life, it's very difficult to get 4 people in a room together. That was their justification for not having couch co-op. So I'm hoping that there's been a couple other games that have been slowly bringing it back, so I'm hoping this is the return of couch co-op. If not for every game, for a reasonable amount of them.
Yeah.
Because I miss that. I miss that a lot.
No, definitely, definitely. And I did actually hear an argument about it recently. And I think it was in relation to Halo Infinite. And they were talking about Halo 5. And they said, you know, like, looking back, it would have been impossible for us to do 4-player couch co-op. Because there's such a desire now for people to have the best graphical experience possible. They want to be able to see games in as, you know, what's the word that I would use, the most hyper-realistic way possible. You know, they want these huge, lavish, giant open environments and really, really detailed character models and textures. So to actually then render that 4 times, it becomes really, really difficult. And I hadn't really actually latched onto that idea before until I read that. So I guess it does mean that there needs to be a little pushback on, you know, it's not just the developer side, it's also on the audience side as well.
Yep.
But there needs to be a little pushback and say, right, okay, you know, we can do this, but there's going to have to be some sacrifices at the same time.
Well, that's a debate that's been rumbling on the gaming industry since Crysis came out.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's whether people want graphical fidelity or whether they want the couch co-op experience.
It's like maybe in however many years I'll sound like the guy talking about how they could never beat the locomotive for faster thing, but how much better looking can games get at this point?
oh, well, it, you know, it, we'll say that every single time a new console comes out. And I think that when you look at the ray tracing technology, it really is breathtaking. It is absolutely breathtaking. It looks so incredibly realistic. And obviously, you know, that's because the light is operating in the exact same way the light does in real life. You know, it naturally bounces off of things. And I think that when you see stuff like that, it really does show you how much further these things can go. And, you know, people can, you know, you can, they have huge NVIDIA workstations that have four graphics cards in that people use for actually developing the games. And eventually, you know, that technology at some point will be in such a form factor that you can plop it under your TV and play games on it. It's really, really crazy, especially when you look at the stuff that they're doing with Unreal Engine. It's insane, the level of detail, the level of fidelity that they're making now. But again, you know, is that what people are necessarily going to want? You know, do we want completely photorealistic games? Sometimes, yes, I guess, is the answer, but not always. And I think it was interesting that this year's E3, that wasn't always the highlight. Mm-hmm. It wasn't always about pushing the boundaries of what people could expect from graphical fidelity. It was actually more about what good games can we make.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you look at things like, I guess, Fortnite's maybe a good example, that it doesn't, Minecraft's the best example, but obviously that game's been out for a good while now, that shows that you don't need to have the most photorealistic game in the world to get a huge number of people on board.
Mm-hmm. One other thing that I do want to talk about, and partially it is that kind of graphical fidelity thing in my expectations now, but the new Star Wars game.
It's an interesting one.
With the all of the weird doughy faces of the protagonist that came out afterwards. Maybe that's me becoming spoiled to certain things. Like if you look at Cyberpunk or whatever, and then you look at that, there's a noticeable difference in how much detail there is in the face, and it makes them look real dumb.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that's maybe a unique example. I feel like that there's actually possibly something that they've done wrong there, rather than it not being because it's completely photorealistic. Because I feel like the main character walks like he's got rickets as well.
Yeah,
there seem to be design choices with it.
Well, I guess in the Krogy Cat video, the Mass Effect Andromeda squat sprint thing.
Exactly. It's really strange, really, really strange. And I think there's a few strange things about that game. And I'm glad that you pointed that out, because there's another game as well that I'll get to later, which has also sort of made me feel a little weird for those reasons as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Star Wars game, it didn't sell me. And I thought it was going to. And I don't know if that's just because I'm so disappointed that the Amy Hennig-led Volition project isn't happening.
Yeah.
Or whether or not it just because it didn't excite me. But I think it's more the latter. I think that there wasn't just anything that really brought home how good a narrative-driven single-player Star Wars game could be.
It felt very...
It was sanitized.
Very boilerplate-y. Like,
it felt Disney.
Yeah, like, there was nothing about it that really surprised me, apart from maybe like Forrest Whitaker suddenly showing up.
Exactly.
And I suppose
that sort of does that a lot in films. Yeah, I feel like.
Yeah, like, I suppose that shows that's the show when it'll be set. But like, I can't take that character seriously.
No, definitely not.
Yeah. Disclosure for anyone listening: I really, really, really did not like Rogue One. And that character and like the save the dream and all that has been a punchline for me ever since it came out, and I mostly sort of blanked him from my memory until he appeared again in that thing, which was a bit of whiplash for me personally.
Yeah, definitely. Now it just feels it feels to me very, very Disney. It feels like there are executives breathing over the shoulders of Respawn throughout the development of that game, telling them what they could and couldn't do. Because if you look back at a game like Star Wars The Force Unleashed, that looks fantastic compared to Jedi Fallen Order, I feel like. When you go back and play those games, they're a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. You know, you can be Jedi or Sith, you know, and that's fantastic. I really like that idea, and I thought that was a really standout game.
Did you see the interview during the, I think it was the EA Play thing, where they asked them about that.
Yeah, and they were really jilted about it.
Yeah, they
went,
no.
No, they almost kind of took offense to it. So yeah, it's a strange one.
Yeah, you're looking forward to the, as they have already shown with pre-order bonuses, the multitude of skins for the little droid.
Yeah, of course.
All of the droid skins and the black lightsaber will come back. It always does.
Yeah.
Apparently, I saw things on Twitter about it being way more kind of Metroid-y than they let on with that trailer.
Apparently so, yeah, apparently so. I think it was maybe Jason Schreier from Kotaku. He was talking about it and saying that it was a lot more of a Metroidvania than people thought. I don't know whether to believe that or not. That's coming from the developers talking about that more so than the gameplay that people saw. It kind of makes sense as to why they wouldn't show it. I guess they want to make the game as accessible as possible. They want everyone to see it and go, oh, this looks fun. This looks like a Star Wars game. You can play as a Jedi rather than bogging the game down with things that people may be disinterested in.
Yeah, and I suppose the final sort of thing, which may make me more harsh on the game than maybe I should be, I was kind of ahead of my previous mentioning of their new title. I'm a big fan of From Software. And they copied Sekiro's homework quite a bit.
Definitely.
Like, to the point where it was not shocking, but I was able to, like, piece out and map out all the different things that were the same and, like, how that, like, even animations were similar. Like,
definitely.
And I guess that, like, that's not the worst thing because the combat in Sekiro was really, really good.
Yeah.
But it was just kind of odd.
No, definitely. It did feel like it was less so inspired and more just a carbon copy of. And I think, you know, look at the climbing in it as well. That looked very Uncharted-like, very Tomb Raider-esque. The wall running looked very Titanfall-esque as well. It didn't feel like an inspired title that maybe like Shadow of Mordor is, where you go, okay, the guys who made this clearly played games that they really enjoyed. They've clearly played Assassin's Creed. They've played the Arkham games, and they want a game that has combat or stealth elements that feel similar to that.
Yeah.
It felt more like, this is popular. We should do it too. And that sounds very, just saying that, that sounds exactly almost like Disney's ethos, you know? This is popular, let's do it. So I really hope that the game hasn't been infected too much by what the Disney execs want in terms of accessibility, and that we're given some sort of, leeway to have some creative.
Yeah, for sure. There. Yeah, we've talked about a lot of big games and big properties. Is there any sort of... Because there was quite a lot of indie games shown across all the different sort of...
Definitely, there's a few standouts for me. Obviously, I talked about Carrion already before. And the other two that I really liked the look of were 12 Minutes, which pushes all the right buttons for me. That's the kind of game that I like. You know, it's promising a lot, but at the same time, I don't think I'm the only one who came out of that Microsoft presentation and had the trailer of 12 Minutes burned in their retinas. Because it was really, really exciting. Yeah. And it's a really clever premise as well. And something that seems to be quite popular at the moment as well.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see how that works and how that pans out. Like, I've seen quite a few other sort of indie games that I've played with that repeating type of thing. But none that have been done in that very particular sort of style.
Yeah, definitely.
And it seems like it's going to go some dark places.
Definitely, definitely. And, I always like that sort of thing. You know, that sort of crime storytelling... Mm-hmm. type thing, especially where you have to like look around places and find clues, like the old, like I don't know if you played them, but the old Flash games like Red Room and White Room, where you have to go into all these different rooms and try and find little keys or codes and things. I loved playing those games, and it really did feel quite claustrophobic, and the games didn't have a narrative, but the narrative was sort of created by the puzzle solving, and I really, really liked that, and this seems to be inspired by that, I think.
Yeah. There was one game, talking about Flash games and puzzle phones, it made me think of it. Maybe you can remember what it is, or maybe if whoever listens to this can remember it. There was an old game, I'm pretty sure it was on like Newgrounds or something, which kind of dates us. And it was that kind of thing where basically you got murdered at the start and you were a ghost. And you had to go about the town and like figure out clues about how you died, and you helped put other ghosts to peace.
Right,
and it was like a whole thing. And I'm pretty sure I came back to it years later and the writing was nowhere near as good as my young self thought it was. But I remember it being pretty good. I don't know if you know what it's called.
No, I've absolutely no idea.
I've forgotten its name for years and years. I've never been able to find it. So that's the quest.
But yeah, definitely. It's definitely sort of reminiscent of that, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. How about yourself? Any wee indie titles that piqued your interest?
I didn't fully appreciate it at the time because I can't even remember what it was called. It was terrible. But the indie game that came directly after Cyberpunk, where you're basically like the boatman on the River Styx, but it's all kind of nice and stylized.
It's little spirits. It's very Spirited Away vibes that game had. The sort of, you were like a steamboat operator for taking people to the afterlife. Mm-hmm. I like that as well. That looks really cool.
It just seemed very pleasant.
Yeah, exactly. And another one that sort of had similar vibes to that was Way to the Woods with the two deer, which again, just looks pleasant. It looks really pleasant and fun to play, and I like little games like that.
Yeah, for sure. It's not really related to anything, but a special little thing I wanted. No, it was sort of off the wall coverage of the Ubisoft thing by Polygon. I don't know if you watched it.
No, I haven't seen it.
I suppose they're trying to maintain a bit more of a professional atmosphere while still being weird and goofy.
Yeah.
Rather than doing a drinking game during it, you know, the guy who does the breakdown things where he does like the analysis and all that kind of stuff. He ate beans every time they did one of the things. And that guy ate a lot of beans.
Very strange.
Over the course of like how long, like an hour. And it's interesting watching a man slowly break like that.
Yeah, just through beans.
Eating cold beans.
I've never seen that.
I'll show you after this. It's they still maintain a pretty decent like live stream out of it. It's not one of those things where like it descends into just jokes and memes and overreact. It's still pretty chill, but it was just a man eating beans watching a Ubisoft presentation called Clutch Royale, where they play the Kingsman music to show one of the new operators that's just come out, but then don't show the other operator in the trailer.
Strange. I'll have to give that a watch, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. Well, on the subject of weird, it's an interesting segue here, but one game that I really wanted to get on board with, but something about it just really jarred me, is Crystal Dynamics Avengers game. I don't know what you thought about that, but I really struggled to get on board.
Talking video game characters with weird faces.
exactly.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's just because
Major Columbia and all of that.
Not
Captain America. Well, that and the whole, it's got microtransactions.
Oh, jeez.
Single player campaign with microtransactions. I thought we learned this with Shadow of War.
Yeah, exactly. No, I couldn't get on board. And one of the faces is one thing. And like, I understand their argument that, you know, this is our vision for the Avengers. Well, if that's the case, why did you make all the Avengers look exactly the same as they look in the films, but with different faces?
Yeah, it's like they look exactly as in the film, but they've like spaced the eyes out further and stuff like that. Give them a different haircut.
Exactly. So I don't, that argument kind of falls apart. And also, I'm really unsure about how they're going to go about the co-op. It was the co-op that I really liked. I was like, yes, Avengers, you can play with your mates, you know, but not split screen. That's fine. That's fine by me, you know. And, you know, one of you can play as the Hulk, one of you can play as Captain America, but they didn't show any of that. And I think that what we're going to see is a really boiled down version of the single player campaign where you perhaps just have to defeat enemies in a horde style mode or something like that. You know, I was expecting like a city-wide multiplayer Avengers game where, you know, almost like a free roam type thing. You know, I don't know if you remember like the old PS2, like Hulk Ultimate Destruction type thing, or, you know, like Arkham City, you know, perhaps not to that scale, but something where, you know, you could, as the Avengers, work together. You know, I just imagined in my head the idea of Galactus coming down into New York City, and you've got Hulk climbing up his body, and you've got, you know, Hawkeye up on the skyscraper shooting him with arrows and all these different things. Whereas it seems a lot more tailored than that for the single player.
Yeah, I think I was just double checking the name of it there. I think it's just going to make me miss the old Marvel Ultimate Alliance games.
Yeah, definitely. Well, there's another one of those coming out. Yeah. They showed that at E3 as well. Obviously, it's a different experience. It's a totally different kind of game. But yeah, exactly. You know, those games were really fun because you could just be like, you know, it was like a fighting beat 'em up style roster where you could be like, right, what superhero do I want to play as? And that was really cool. And this one obviously is different, and I get that. Obviously, they're coming from making the most recent Tomb Raider series. So obviously, they're very much into the narrative-driven story game format. But at the same time, I thought that the whole game was going to be co-op. I didn't realise that the campaign was single-player only. An interesting one.
Yeah. I think most ambitious crossover of the whole of E3, and I think this is me pretty much out of talking points after this.
Yeah.
I never thought I would see Kenny Omega of wrestling fame on a round table discussion with Boogie. Like that threw me off in such a way. Apart from maybe the Todd Howard and Elon Musk thing,
that was even stranger.
God damn, that
really
was
hard to watch.
That was the crowning oh no E3 thing for me.
Yeah, definitely.
Like,
definitely.
Asking Elon what kind of games he wanted and not really knowing what to say, more R-rated.
Well, basically, it sounded like he was saying that he wanted to have more porn games.
Yeah.
He wanted VR porn games, was basically what he was getting at.
But that entire thing for me was encapsulated in the first question of the Q&A, where this guy went on a long, rambling point about how we're all in a simulation, and they just went, okay, thank you for that, and moved on. Like, that was it.
Very strange. Yeah.
The next question was, how much do I need to beg Elon for a selfie? He's an interesting man. We've seen the various forms of Elon, but I don't think I've ever seen him as uncomfortable as he was in that room.
No, definitely. And no wonder, you know. Jeff Keighley's coming out and saying, oh, you know, you guys are friends, and the two of them are sort of like, do we have to say that we're friends? I don't know how they managed to get on board with him. I don't know if they paid him or what, but... Yeah, I'm really not sure what they were going for with that. I don't even understand the relevance. Why were they getting him on stage?
I think Todd Howard was there for like damage control, which the one good question of the Q&A, what's your biggest failure that you've had to overcome, which Todd Howard obviously didn't answer because we all know what the answer is.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, he's a tech guy to an extent, I guess, Elon, but like...
He's not a games guy.
Is that a meme thing?
I think it is. And I think this leads on to probably, well, I say it's my last point, but I don't want to make such a negative point my final talking point, but the whole of Bethesda's E3 conference, especially anything Fallout related.
Battle Royale.
Yeah, Battle Royale's come to Fallout 76. And the whole thing was really hard to watch, and it was really a sign of, I think, where Bethesda were going, at least with their first party games. You know, obviously you've got things like Doom Eternal and this Tokyo Ghostwire and stuff, and these things look like promising projects. But in terms of Bethesda's first party games, they were literally going off the good graces of the few people who are playing Fallout still. And, you know, the promise of Starfield and Elder Scrolls 6 in the future, you know, when he's coming out and he's saying, you know, and Elder Scrolls 6, and sort of waits for people to just applaud him just for saying the name without showing anything, I think is really a sign of the fact that they are now really just going off the good graces of their fans.
Yeah. Do you think that they addressed the Fallout 76 thing enough? Because they said that thing about how they received like well-deserved criticism and all that, and they talked about stuff being free.
I think it was all absolute rubbish. I think that it was him coming out in the same way that he always does, where he expects to be forgiven for the studio's mistakes by just making a joke about it. And it's the exact same thing he did with Fallout 4 with the paid mods, and it's the same thing that he's always done. And I think that it's I think it's absolute rubbish. And I don't understand, you know, there's a reason why they started letting the public into E3 events as well, because they need those people to cheer along when they announce that there's going to be NPCs and quest lines added to Fallout 76. Those should be a given in a game like that, and it's crazy that they're still, even now, and you know, until they come out in winter, non-existent in a Fallout game. You know, that's why that they've got all those people half drunk clapping and cheering away at the fact there's going to be NPCs in Fallout. So yeah, I think it was absolute rubbish, and I don't think it saved them, not by a long shot. And it remains to be seen whether this Fallout 76 content will actually bring people back onto the game, but I suspect it will be going free to play soon enough.
It's long gone for me.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. You know, they announced that, I think, between the 10th and 17th, it was going to be a free to play. I downloaded it. I didn't turn it on once. I didn't switch it on once. I had absolutely no desire to play it whatsoever.
Yeah. I suppose if it... I'll leave it on a happy point. Banjo Kazooie in Smash.
Yeah, that's a happy point, definitely. That's cool. I like that.
That's great.
And that's, I think, as well as a sign of the relationship, growing relationships between, you know, Microsoft and Nintendo and Sony and Microsoft. You know, the three of them, I think they've shown that they maybe are actually, you know, going to afford their letting their licenses be used on other things now. And that's exciting. That's a positive note to look forward to for the future, I think. And I think we will start to see more of that. So, it's been an interesting E3, I would say.
Yeah.
And it's been one that I think very much that they may not have shown new hardware, and they may not have shown things that were coming far, far into the future. But I think a lot of the talking points of this year were really telling of the way that the games industry is going to go over the next few years. I think we're going to see a lot more polished indie titles getting real headlines in the future. I think that we're going to see a lot more developers really making an effort to avoid crunch. A lot of them talked about that as well. I think we're going to see huge changes in the landscape of hardware in terms of not just console offerings next year, but beyond that as well. And I think as well that that studios, developers, publishers are now going to have to start to take a lot more responsibility for things, you know, because they are asking people for a huge amount of investment a lot of the time on false promises. And that's now shown. You know, look at Fallout 76, look at Anthem. Where was Anthem this year at E3? So I think that that's really a positive point to take as well, is that, you know, studios and publishers really are going to actually have to start taking responsibility.
Yeah, I just think as well, the ship, apart from like doing all that, the nice positive part of Bethesda's presentation was, just double check her name, Akumi Nakamura.
Yeah,
it was nice, female developer, and that, but coming across, someone again coming across very genuine, quite charming, and the internet largely being quite nice about it.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, again, that's another interesting change that we're going to see in the industry as well. It's still got a long way to go. I think it's something at like 22% of people in the industry are women. So it's still got a long way to go for sure. But again, you know, it's a sign of the times, and it's a positive sign for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I'm talked out.
Yeah, me too. I think we should maybe leave it at that.
Yeah, definitely.
So thank you for joining me, and we'll do this over the next few weeks when we'll start hopefully a semi-regular trend of something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue.
Yeah.
And we'll go from there.
Yeah, we'll see you guys there.
Bye-bye.